We would never work with a community until we brought them on board, that they understood why we were doing something that we were doing, that they also understood the fact that if they participated in research, there was no guarantee that we would have something at the end of it that would necessarily benefit them. But we did design our projects in such a way that even if the hypothesis or the study itself was not a huge success, we left people behind and we trained people from the community that were always assets which would remain in the community.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Well, welcome to a special edition of Vox Dev Talks. In the next few months, we are going to be investigating how research is put into practice, what's done well, what could be done better, what economists might learn from other disciplines. And we're going to be talking to experts in many different areas of policy. Today, we are focusing on healthcare, and I'm talking to Dr. Zulfikar Bhutta of the Centre for Global Child Health in Toronto. He also splits his time with the Aga Khan University, where he is the founding director of the Institute for Global Health and Development and the Centre of Excellence in Women and Child Health. There's also a huge list of other things that take his time. I won't read out now because it will be the rest of the podcast. But Zulfikar, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
My pleasure.
Usually on Vox Dev Talks, we interview economists, but your training is as a physician, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a pediatrician by training, but sort of somewhere along the way, I saw the light and diverted to public health. So I do global child health. And for the last several decades, I've been involved in trying to see what can be done at scale for children across the world, particularly in low and middle income countries. Mm-hmm. And I've been working at the interface of evidence-informed policies and implementation.
Mm-hmm. And your specialization is in maternal child adolescent health. Has that always interested you, even when you were working as a physician?
No, my training actually, Tim, is a neonatologist. I started off by specializing in the care of the very small babies. Mm-hmm. That's what I did for a good chunk of my time for the first 10, 15 years. But that also meant that you couldn't do newborn medicine without looking at the mother.
Yes.
So I started my clinical training as an obstetrician, then diverted to newborn medicine, and then headed a very large clinical program for training and referral care of very small babies in Pakistan, all the way from the mid-80s to, I would say, the late 90s. And around that time, then diverted, as I just mentioned, to much more global issues and issues related to population health. And over time, have expanded my repertoire of things to beyond the newborn period to the entire childhood, 0 to 20 years of age, which does include school-age children, which does include adolescents, and is a much wider spectrum than I had ever imagined I would be doing.
How did you accomplish that shift into public health? Did you have to retrain? What inspired you to do it?
Unfortunately, at the time when I began my clinical training and practice, the discipline of global health did not exist. Mm-hmm. Neither did population health of the kind that I eventually ended up doing. So one had to learn on the job, and one had to learn by doing. So a lot of the stuff that I've done and that I now teach many of my students was stuff that I learned myself the hard way, making mistakes, doing things, going out in the field and applying whatever little I knew. So in a nutshell, the kind of studies that I'm involved in are basically what we call large effectiveness evaluations.
Yeah.
They differ from standard research where you do a trial on 100 people here, on 100 people there. Much of the studies that I've been engaged in the last several decades have been around population-based interventions at scale, looking at a whole district, million population, sometimes more than that, and doing interventions that are very firmly embedded within the public sector programs. So not hiring and firing your own people, but working with people who exist within government programs, particularly community health workers. So, as you know, the recipe book for working with community health workers did not exist at that time.
Yes.
So we kind of learned by doing and by actually failing, succeeding at times, but building an entire community of practice around ourselves as to what works, what doesn't work. And some of those lessons have principally moved the needle in global health across many geographies, not just in the region where I work.
Tell me about the regions in which you work. Where do you specialize?
So a lot of my work, by default, because I went back to Pakistan after training in 1985, has been in Pakistan. And fortunately, by the time I decided to move out, there was a ready program that I could collaborate with, which was a community health workers program developed by the government called Lady Health Workers Program.
Yeah.
These are volunteer women who work in rural populations. So much of my interest was in rural areas. And this was a program that I developed good link with. And we were able to test sequentially many things that these community health workers could do and ended up by moving the field forward in appropriate domiciliary community-based care. But the geographies that I work in are not restricted to Pakistan. I then expanded my work into the more difficult tribal areas, conflict-affected areas, the border areas between Pakistan and Afghanistan. I've done a fair amount of work in Afghanistan, in Central Asia. And because my university has a very significant footprint in East Africa, Khan University spans many, several continents, a lot of my work now also includes Africa. So if you take the low and middle income countries at large, or let's say the 98 or 99 countries which have almost all the burden of premature mortality of mothers and children, I've worked in most areas and have learned by working in those areas, either in the field myself or by working with secondary analysis and collaborators in trying to understand how things change.
Do you think it is important for someone in your position to get out into the field and not do this all behind a desk?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. You can't do this sitting in an office and in a five-star hotel. Work patterns have changed post-COVID. A lot of us now work remotely, but I spend a lot of my time in the field and with my staff. Increasingly, I don't have to go to the field every day, but there were periods of time when I was doing some of my work where this would be part of my routine. So yes, you learn by doing, but in rural areas, you also have to pace yourself and develop a program where you can work with other people, because short of transplanting yourself into a rural outpost and staying there for years, the only way of doing that is to build a team. So I've built teams, and I'm so very proud of them. The teams of people that I work with in Pakistan, I work with in other geographies, I work with here in Toronto, and they are the best and the brightest and the most motivated young people who want to change the world to a better place.
In talking to other people who've worked in the field in community health, you realize that it is extremely hard work and can be very frustrating. You've been doing this for quite a while now. Would you say to them, stick with it because you can achieve things?
Well, there are several ways of working with communities. Some are things that we would never advise people to do, even though it may be easier, at times seem easier, and people do that without necessarily building that rapport, that understanding, that relationship with communities that is so important for work. A lot of people think that that's maybe not necessary. You have a project, you go in flashing your dollars and your resources and principally implement your project. And in many poor communities, people will participate in research because sometimes it's the only way for them to get some degree of benefit, which is unfortunate, but is a reality.
Yes.
Our approach had been the total opposite from the very beginning. We would never work with a community until we brought them on board, that they understood why we were doing something that we were doing, that they also understood the fact that if they participated in research, there was no guarantee that we would have something at the end of it that would necessarily benefit them. But we did design our projects in such a way that even if the hypothesis or the study itself was not a huge success, we left people behind and we trained people from the community that were always assets which would remain in the community. In one of my rural districts in Pakistan, where I've been working for the last, you know, I would say 25 years or so, that is the fundamental reason why we are held in both high regard and also where people take us pretty seriously when we come with a proposal, because they know that we have the staying power and also that we will work with them and not throw a solution at them which they have not been part of.
Do you have particular examples of where research has influenced policy that has been able to make a difference as a way in which things should be done?
Oh, tons. My very first project that actually changed global policy significantly was based on the principle of trying to save newborn lives in home settings where babies would not necessarily either be born in hospitals or be taken to hospitals. And if they had problems, they would need to be seen pretty quickly. And to address that, we put a project in place. I'm going back to 1998, 99, where we worked with the community to first understand barriers and what needed to change, and then worked with the Lady Health Workers Program to see if we could put in a simple enough, not very high-powered, fancy, difficult, but a simple enough process of community mobilization and working with women in the communities. And all we did was to encourage male volunteers to give them the space, the support, the elbow room, to have them work with women in their own communities, to empower them, to give them the information, and to also encourage them to implement evidence-informed good strategies at home and partake of whatever was available in the health system. The results were phenomenal. This took me 5 years at that time and an enormous amount of resources, but the results were unbelievable. We were able to demonstrate a reduction in deaths by about 20%, which, you know, at a population level of about a million is not insignificant. We were also able to show that many of those impacts were sustained even after we left. So we showed that during the course of the cluster randomized trial that we did, people began to go to hospitals. The care seeking patterns changed. And then 4 years after we had gone, we went back to see if they had regressed to where they were before. No, they hadn't. When people start seeing the benefit in something, they don't go back and regress to a less than optimal health status. So that project was the first with public sector programs, changed global policy in terms of community health workers, and also influenced the development of a very large program in India. At that time in Pakistan, lady health workers were only about 60 or 70,000. India was able to put in a program with a million health workers based on the same principles of working with communities, families, and was able to expand that also. So yeah, I mean, these projects have a way of snowballing. Sometimes they can have impacts in directions that you least expected.
Do you still have examples of projects now that have that level of impact?
Yeah, I'm doing one right now, which I'm very confident, just going by the response that we have to that from communities, that will make a lot of difference in that geography. And that's a project on trying to build community resilience and adaptation against climate change, particularly extreme heat. Many people are not aware of the impact of extreme heat and conditions on health, particularly the health of women and young infants, because this has just never been conceived as an issue before. And it's also that it's also become a problem in the last decade or so. I mean, the average number of days that you have people exposed to temperature, particularly pregnant women, women who work in the fields, to temperatures above 40, 45 degrees centigrade. I mean, that's not trivial. Mm-hmm. Yet the community adaptation around some of those has not been perfect. And that's why there's a high burden of morbidity and ill effects of this. So my team is now working on developing a package in consultation with the community, which is low-cost interventions, awareness, and also adaptation, which is feasible and possible within the sociocultural setup. If we succeed in a year or two in demonstrating that that did impact health and other outcomes, improved maternal health in particular, reduced some of the gender disparities that we see around climate change and its impact, I think that will push the needle on so many things that will happen, even before COP27 or COP28 or beyond are able to get their act together. We can't, in issues like this, which are basically existential, wait forever for the global agencies to get their act together. So this is community empowerment, and this is learning from the traditional wisdom of communities at times that has been discarded over the years.
Has there been examples of any research which you have seen and, well, it has surprised, it's challenged you, but you have been able to put it into practice and you've seen those results?
We, a long time ago, also did one of the first trials of looking at how we could improve the care of the newborn baby by cleaning the cord with an antiseptic solution when they were delivered at home in dirty conditions and whether or not that would make an impact. And it's surprised me to see how much impact it had on reducing morbidity and mortality. Not just because people did that antiseptic application with chlorhexidine, but also because they stopped doing other things which were harmful. Now, that changed global policy, and this is now something that WHO has also picked up as something that they do in circumstances where deliveries take place in less than hygienic circumstances. But, you know, you haven't asked me this, but I will tell you that some of the best projects that I've been involved in, where I think there has been global learning, are those that failed. Because they also told us the limits of interventions. You know, it's not that everything that you put in place succeeds.
Mm-hmm.
So these community health workers that I've been working with for, and as I said, you know, the last 30 plus years, sometimes you also have the misperception that they can do everything and that, you know, you could put additional burden on them of new interventions, of new targets and new things to do without something giving way. And we have learned over time that there are things that will work in the hands of community outreach workers and health workers, and there are things that they are ill-equipped or perhaps ill-placed to implement. And that's where you need to perhaps go to other interventions in the health system at facility level to make a difference. So the balance between what you do at population level in communities and what you do in health systems is something that you learn over time, and I've learned more from my negative studies than I have from maybe the few positive ones that I've been involved in.
A large part of our audience are development economists. Is there anything that you feel that you've learned from interacting with economists?
Yeah, I mean, I learn all the time by interacting with economists. I've learned also how important it is to keep the host principle of cost effectiveness in mind and also the principles of scale. Some of the best social experiments that I've seen and have seen the impact of have been the kind of things that development economists have come up with. Recently, I evaluated some of the results and outcomes from a very large health insurance scheme that was implemented in the north of Pakistan called Sehat Sahulat Card. It's a card that gives a family a certain amount of money. And like many other academics, I was very skeptical in terms of, you know, how much can they achieve? What would be the proportion of malfeasance when money changes hand at that scale? And I was also very interested to see if it would reach those who had relative easier access, whether it would increase disparities rather than reduce disparities.
Mm-hmm.
I was very pleasantly surprised as to how much impact it had on reducing inequities, how much impact it had on increasing access of care, access to care for those who would never imagine coming to a hospital for tertiary care and surgery in the past. I mean, obviously, I was able to identify areas where they could do better. For example, moving into much more preventive mode and primary care mode as opposed to tertiary. But, you know, that's a development step that comes step by step. So what I'm saying is that I think the best opportunities for making impact are when geeks like me who are from the health research perspective and more implementation research join hands with development economists. And we did exactly that. I mean, as part of the disease control priorities project, the last one, there is a new one coming out, DCP3. I mean, we learned a tremendous amount by interacting with development economists, people who were able to translate a lot of the work that we were involved in into dollar and dime figures to say, if you want to make that investment or that choice, this is what it will cost. And if you don't, then this is the alternative. Those partnerships, Tim, should increase. And sadly, they're not the common way of doing things.
Sophie, the field of public health research has expanded enormously since you were one of the pioneers of it. Is there still a category of things that we just don't know enough about yet?
The two areas that I will point out to you, one that I initiated 6-7 years ago, because there was no work in that space. So I set up a consortium of universities, some of the best academic centers in the Northern Hemisphere, in partnership with universities from the South. It was called Branch Consortium, Bridging Research for Action for Improving Maternal and Child Health in Conflict and Humanitarian Settings. So we researched, first of all, what burden of global mortality, morbidity for women and children existed in geographies where conflict was not only acute, but you had these never-ending wars and long-standing conflict circumstances, such as you have in the Horn of Africa, such as in my own backyard. You know, I come from the north of Pakistan. I was a young graduated when I worked in my first refugee camp because of the Afghan war. Look at where we are now. I'm now an old man. So these things have a habit of perpetuation. So nobody works on those areas. The only people who work on those areas are implementation bodies like NGOs, very well-meaning NGOs and heroes, in my opinion, but they're generally not led by science. So our objective in that consortium was to build the scientific basis for doing better, to make the case for more research in those circumstances so that you make the right choices. And I think a series of papers that we produced in The Lancet pushed the needle a bit further. And then, unbeknown to us, we were hit by COVID and the world came to a standstill. A lot of our implementation work beyond that particular project did not take place because there was just no way of doing things during the 2 or 3 years that the world had come to a standstill. But the Lord works in mysterious ways. And in some ways, it was good that I didn't rush and do anything, because now what I am engaged in pushing the branch consortium for is actually to work on complex crises. Because even conflict itself is a very narrow definition of what those poor people go through. I mean, these complex crises, whether it is COVID or post-COVID pandemics, whether it is conflict, whether it is cost of living, or it's climate change, these are things which are intimately intertwined. In my own country where I work, Pakistan, you go to rural populations of Sindh, and you can't talk to them about one thing. They are dealing with many things simultaneously. They're dealing with existential floods and climate change. They are dealing with food insecurity. They are dealing with the fact that they can't afford to put one square meal a day on the table. And they're dealing with the fact that they also have health crises that are becoming more common in the wake of such outbreaks. And also importantly, they are dealing with issues of quality of care in health facilities. You need to develop a strategy for working which is more around complex preparedness. So while I just told you that I'm doing this climate change package for heat adaptation, I know that that package eventually will have to also include issues of affordability, cost effectiveness, will also include things that have to be done for that community to become more resilient around their own food security. And it'll also have to include issues that have to do with better management of disease outbreaks and preparedness. These things are intertwined, and the more intertwined they are, the simplistic solutions that only work through one sector do not work. So we need multi-sectoral interventions and approaches. This morning, in a discussion of the SDSN led by Jeff Sachs, this was precisely my point. Looking at this purely from the financial lens is inappropriate. Looking at this purely from a health lens or a climate change lens is also missing the point. You need to increasingly have communities, district governments, provincial governments, and federal governments look at this from the lens of trying to do things together in a much more complex preparedness mode. That's where I'm heading.
And for the specialists involved in this, is it important that the teams that are designing any interventions are also interdisciplinary?
Completely. Absolutely. I think that's where the opportunity and the challenge is. The challenge is very few of them are. You ask people around how many people have anthropologists, how many people have qualitative scientists as part of their team. It's a small fraction. How many have developmental economists, health economists? Very few. I know that in my own program, you know, we would have done with a health economist like yesterday. And also increasingly bringing in the community voices through women, through civic society participants. Participatory planning and development of these projects, I think, is not the exception. It should be the norm. And it's increasingly something that we recognize as we get into more difficult areas.
Sophie, is there something that the development economists can learn from people in your discipline with your background?
I think the more we see developmental economists, and with due respect to most, spending time in the field with grunts like us who spend their days and time working with communities, the better off many of these things would be. I mean, I see many development economists, many of my friends, you know, spending less time in community settings, breaking bread with, sleeping, living, and experiencing some of the things that they are so passionate about and want to change. We would need greater collaboration and development of projects where this becomes the way of designing things.
Are you encouraged that the movement is in that direction?
In some places, yes. In other places, no. I think one of the big, and I'm saying this with great sincerity, one of the unfortunate things that has happened with COVID and the life and way of work after COVID is that more and more people are working remotely.
Yeah.
I think while it has efficiencies, it also means that you lose that human factor in terms of co-designing things by sitting together. So I think increasingly I would encourage people to, in partnerships with low and middle income country researchers, people like myself, is to develop those partnerships on the basis of a mutual common understanding of what you are trying to change. I remember, gosh, you know, this is such a long time ago, Jim Grant paid a visit to Pakistan, which was, I think, mid-80s. And it was at that relatively safe. People wanted him to go to a village close to Karachi. But I remember that he insisted that he wanted to go further out into the interior. Why? Because he wanted to go on an unscripted trip. He wanted to see for himself. He wanted to feel with his own hands and see what was happening with things that he was so passionate about, oral rehydration, immunizations, nutritional monitoring. So that's the kind of spirit that I think we need with people in global development, is to be able to see for yourself firsthand, and not only see and diagnose, but also be part of the solution by seeing and monitoring and assessing the impact of many of the decisions that we take, sometimes in air-conditioned boardrooms, around what a design of an intervention might be.
Zulfi, it's clear that you still have that spirit. Congratulations on everything you've been able to achieve. Thank you very much for talking about it to me today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me.
I also believe that I have to congratulate you because you are the recipient of the 2023 Henry Friesen International Prize in Health Research.
Well, thank you.
It's going to make your CV even longer. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You will find us there. And if you do miss an episode, all the past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles on the papers we feature.